From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
The Trump-Kim summit is canceled, but both Trump and Kim are expressing hope it will be uncanceled. What's going on in our rocky thaw with North Korea, and are we losing the maximum pressure coalition to keep them at the table? And why didn't we consult the South Koreans before pulling out? Trump is furious with his Homeland Security Secretary, who he thinks hasn't been tough enough on the border, even as her department orders the separation of families of asylum seekers. Does he expect Kirstjen Nielsen to build the wall herself? Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, Starbucks stores will close the afternoon of May 29 for anti-bias training. We'll talk with one of Starbucks' advisors on that training, Heather McGee of Demos. We'll talk with Stephen Brill about his new book, Tailspin, regarding the decline of American institutions. All that plus Trump going off script on the importance of voting this November is coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Heather McGee, president of the progressive policy groups Demos and Demos Action. The summit is off for now. President Trump issued a letter Thursday morning saying he would not meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore next month. Trump said the tremendous anger and open hostility displayed in recent North Korean statements made it impossible to proceed at this time. He issued a threat, saying American nuclear capabilities are so massive and powerful, he hoped not to have to use them. But he also thanked Kim in his letter for the recent release of American hostages and even left the door open to putting the meeting back on again, saying Kim should, quote, not hesitate to call or write if his attitude toward diplomacy changes. The North Koreans responded to the letter in a more gentle manner than you might expect, expressing their great regret at the cancellation. North Korea's foreign minister said in his own letter that the disconnect between the U.S. and North Korea shows, quote, the urgent necessity for the summit meeting for the improvement of ties. And he expressed Kim's continued willingness to meet. On Twitter Friday morning, Trump called the North Korean statement warm and productive. He also said on Friday, we're going to see what happens. It could even be the 12th. We're talking to them now. They very much want to do it. We'd like to do it. To discuss these developments, we're joined now by Evelyn Farkas, who's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia in the Obama administration. Evelyn, what do you make of these developments of the last few days?
I think it's all part and parcel of this very haphazard diplomatic style our president has. You know, we saw the Secretary of State going over and laying the groundwork for a negotiation, admittedly a backwards negotiation, you know, starting with the heads of state. But he was trying to fill in the gaps. You know, I would imagine, we don't know exactly what they discussed, but he did give us a bit of a sense that there would be some kind of potential economic carrot for the North Koreans. And then obviously the end goal would be this complete verifiable irreversible denuclearization. But the president, his advisors maybe aren't exactly on the same page, because I do believe that John Bolton's statements did have an impact on the North Koreans. And so they made some statements that, of course, then upset the president. And sensing that perhaps the North Koreans might pull away from the summit, although I wouldn't think that that was the case necessarily, because having dealt with the North Koreans myself, They do a lot of on-off, canceling, not showing up for meetings. That's kind of par for the course. But the president took the action that he did very publicly yesterday. But luckily, the North Koreans didn't overreact. And so I think that hopefully we can get back to a regular negotiation, sort of the regular diplomatic order, and have the experts actually handle the situation, handle the negotiations until we have some kind of agreement that the heads of state can agree to.
Can I offer an upside case for why we're better off now than we were, say, 3 or 4 days ago? Which is to say, we were clearly unready to have this summit, in part for the reasons that you're laying out here. And so when Trump issued this letter, he sort of called North Korea's bluff about how much they were concerned about actually having the summit. And he showed that they were really motivated, because he got this sort of measured response, in part drawn by the measured parts in his letter, saying that he was open to continuing to have the meetings, thanking them for the release of the hostages. And now we've bought ourselves time to have sort of a more normal diplomatic buildup instead of rushing into this high stakes meeting, but the thaw is still ongoing. Is that too optimistic a take on what's happened?
Well, what you've left out, Josh, is the impact on our allies, you know, and they're the ones who first and foremost are in the immediate crosshairs of North Korea's conventional weapons program. So leaving aside the nuclear, you know, the Japanese have been subject to repeated missile tests over their territory. The South Koreans obviously are right over the border from an array of artillery that could obliterate millions of people at the flip of a switch. So, you know, the fact that they were left out of the dark on this and actually have been somewhat sidelined, you know, they've been scrambling to get into the game and figure out what our president's, you know, plan is all along with their shuttle diplomacy to Washington. So I think that's a negative impact. And that coupled with what has happened to the Transatlantic Alliance because of the president's disruptive diplomacy, to put it mildly, on the Iran deal, I think has caused damage to relationships that we have to rely on for a whole host of things, including our economic well-being. So I think it's slightly optimistic, although I would agree with you again. As I said from the outset, I think we need to have a normal diplomatic process so I'm not utterly broken down, if you will, that the summit isn't going to take place right now.
As Rich, as Evelyn notes, we've sort of had two different moments in this process where we've blindsided the Japanese by going into this meeting, and then we blindsided the South Koreans by pulling out of this meeting. It seems at each turn like Trump has not taken seriously the need to manage relationships as you build these diplomatic coalitions.
Yeah, that's very important, especially the South Koreans. I think that the Japanese are going to stick with us no matter what. We have a government in South Korea that's absolutely desperate for an opening to the North. And if we adopt what I think would be a sound policy, which is not having this summit and further cracking down on the North and doubling down on the maximum pressure campaign, it's going to be really important to keep the South on board. I think it was a mistake for Trump to agree to the summit in the first place. I'm glad that he's called it off for now. But it seems to me that we are quite likely just in a continuing negotiation over the negotiation leading up to what could be a summit, because Trump leaves the door open in his letter, underlines that in his public remarks, and the North very notably has a conciliatory response to his cancellation.
Heather, this feels like an okay place for us to be compared to other places we might be. I mean, better to you know, negotiate over the negotiation than to, like, make nuclear button threats.
Yes, there's been no immediate loss of life from this particular blunder. Yes,
well, that's,
you're right.
But that's a real achievement.
Oh, God.
And
it's
we got
true.
The three hostages released.
The three hostages were released, yes. You know, I think one of the things that I've taken away from this week is that, you know, a lot of people inside the Beltway put a lot of faith in Mike Pence as sort of the adult in the room who would be, you know, the savior if some sort of impeachment happened. He would come and be the strong conservative and the statesman. I don't know where exactly that came from, but the fact that he went on Fox News doing his sort of Trump-like version of a bluster and ended up being the person who incited the blow up of this deal, of this summit, is, I think, something that conservatives should really be looking at. You know, I think they thought, of course, Trump is going to say dumb things. And I think in some ways, the North Koreans thought, of course, Trump is going to say dumb things. But the idea that Mike Pence would be the one to sort of, I think, quite carelessly invoke the Libya model of a country, you know, voluntarily denuclearizing and then the West supporting regime change right after, I just don't see, other than the moment on Fox News, what the gain was for Mike Pence.
Look, he was being asked about John Bolton's comments. So I think the blame lies squarely with John Bolton. Granted, it's true. I agree with Heather that, you know, Vice President Pence should have just ignored the question, not fuel, you know, put fire on the whatever, put fuel on the fire or reignited the issue of the Libya solution. You know, he should have said, I'm not discussing that. That's not what this is about. And so he wasn't helpful. But I think we have to remember that it was Bolton who brought it up to begin with. The president swatted it away and said, no, no, that's not what we're looking to achieve. But the damage was already done. I mean, Kim Gae-kwan, who already hates Bolton, and, you know, under the previous regime that he served, they called Bolton quote unquote scum. You know, that just caused a trigger reaction. So those negative comments by the North Koreans were not just because they were trying to play a game or demonstrate something to Beijing, or they were bolstered by Beijing, the second meeting in Beijing. It was also really a real reaction to Bolton.
Yeah, Evelyn, what is the role of the Chinese here? Because the president seemed to be sort of insinuating that the reason that North Korea was getting so aggressive was that China had basically taken off the pressure and given them the green light to do that.
Well, I think that's a little bit of Kim and China playing some games here. So there was a second meeting between Kim Jong-un and President Xi in China. And this meeting was not telegraphed to anyone ahead of time, to our knowledge, certainly not to our government. And that really irked President Trump. I mean, he was very public about how annoyed he was. But it was after that meeting that the North Koreans struck a little bit more defiant tone. But it was also around the time that Bolton made his comment about the Libya solution. So it's unclear exactly what caused the North Koreans to kind of stiffen their spine. I think there was visceral anger at Bolton, but they may have also, you know, received some clear instructions from Beijing and felt strengthened that they had Beijing's back ultimately. And so my guess is that China actually told them they had to explode that mountain because that's an environmental hazard for China. And they really don't want them to do any more nuclear testing for that reason alone. But the kind of reconciliation, that public meeting, I think helped Kim Jong-un feel strengthened.
Evelyn Farkas of the Atlantic Council, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Josh.
Trump has meanwhile been hurling allegations that the FBI inappropriately surveilled his campaign since the FBI received information from a confidential informant who spoke with campaign advisors Carter Page and George Papadopoulos during the 2016 campaign. Rich, I'm having trouble understanding what the allegation is here exactly. We already knew that there had been a counterintelligence probe into the Trump campaign or around it, which kicked off because George Papadopoulos had bragged to an Australian diplomat that Russia had offered him dirt on Hillary Clinton in May of 2016. Why would it have been an improper for the FBI to receive information from an informant as part of that counterintelligence investigation?
Well, I think it's extraordinary to launch a counterintelligence investigation against a domestic presidential campaign.
And it's extraordinary for that domestic presidential campaign to be talking to Russia.
Well, I think you can understand launching a counterintelligence investigation against Russia, an adversarial power, for its meddling in our investigation. I think in our election, I think the question of whether a counterintelligence campaign investigation should have started against the campaign is one that bears more scrutiny. And there is a less confrontational way you could have gone about this. Look, Carter Page is on your FBI, could have gone to the Trump campaign. Carter Page is part of your campaign. We've known about him for years. We have fears about his relationship with Russia, and we're duly warning you of that. And I imagine since Carter Page was not a central part of this operation to begin with, he would have been completely jettisoned, and that would have been a good result. But an informant, obviously the idea that there was a spy embedded in the campaign is a lurid exaggeration. But if the roles were reversed, the Democrats would be outraged if this had happened to their campaign and want to get to the bottom of it. So
this all seems to start from an assumption of good faith, though.
Yeah.
Well, so far, the whole Russia collusion story, the one thing we've not seen any evidence of in the Mueller investigation, we have now taxi fraud, cab fraud in New York City. We have lobbying violations that the Department of Justice knew about for years with Paul Manafort. We've had people lying to the FBI, which they shouldn't do. What we so far have no evidence of collusion.
We have 19 people who have been indicted, 5 guilty pleas, including 3 Trump campaign associates, and 2 of them are pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about their contacts with Russia. It doesn't bear a lot more scrutiny to say that I should hope that our counterintelligence system would be looking at what went on almost a year ago now.
We're going to leave that there. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Heather McGee of Demos to talk about immigration. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Heather McGee, president of Demos. After a decline during President Trump's first year in office, illegal crossings of the Mexican-U.S. border are rising again, and the Washington Post reports that statistic has Trump venting his anger at Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. The Post reports he yelled at her, "We're closed," in a cabinet meeting last month where he harangued her over matters including the failure to build a border wall, an initiative that would require congressional funding beyond Nielsen's control. We're joined now by Nick Miroff, correspondent for the Washington Post, who reported about that cabinet meeting. Hi, Nick.
Hi, good to be with you.
So what is the crux of the president's discontent with his own cabinet secretary here?
Well, I think she's in a really difficult position because there are broader forces that are you know, in a large, arguably out of her control. I mean, the economy right now is very hot, as we know, and unemployment is very low, and so that has produced a huge magnet for labor. And it's no secret in Central America that that employers are hiring, and in some cases, people who are on their way here already have jobs. And you know, compounded with the arrival of thousands of families and unaccompanied minors, many of whom plan to apply for asylum here because they're fleeing violence in Central America, you know, that has driven the numbers up again and really returned them to what they have, the historical averages have been over the last 5 or 6 years. Last year, in the months immediately following Trump's win, you know, that was a bit of an anomaly. And now we're kind of back to normal levels at the border.
At the same time, Nielsen's involved in two very controversial initiatives of the administration. One is to separate parents and children who arrive at the border together without visas and seek asylum, a policy which makes it possible to hold the parents in detention, which you wouldn't be able to do with the whole families. And then also an effort to get Mexico to agree to require Central American migrants to seek asylum there instead of proceeding to the U.S. border. What's the idea behind those two efforts?
Well, I'll start with the latter one, which is the you know, long item that's long been on the wish list of the United States, which would be that Mexico would be a party to an asylum agreement similar to the one we have with Canada, through which the first country that a foreign national seeking asylum arrives at would process their application. And so that would allow American border authorities essentially to turn back asylum seekers, saying, look, you're already in Mexico, you're in a safe third country, and you have no reason to seek safe harbor here. Now, getting Mexico to accept that is another matter, particularly at a time when the president has repeatedly attacked the Mexican government for what he says, you know, doing nothing and allowing, you know, illegal immigrants to just kind of breeze through its territory. And added to that is the fact that there's a presidential election in Mexico on July 1st. And, the current administration is probably not in a position to agree to something quite like that. And then, you know, to your first point about separating families, I think what we're seeing there is, you know, this administration is, and particularly Kirstjen Nielsen as the Secretary of DHS, is in a position to she really needs to do anything and is looking at kind of the toughest measures possible under the law to try to bring these numbers down, knowing that the president is so upset about them. And part of that, you know, is their plan right now to prosecute 100% of illegal border crossers. And the practical effect of that is that if you're traveling with a child and you are facing prosecution and you're going to be in ICE custody, then the government is going to take your child away and put that child in the custody of HHS, Health and Human Services.
Rich, what's our moral obligation to these children? Obviously, they've been through extremely difficult circumstances. They come from countries that are very troubled. They've made a long journey to get to the United States, and then they get here, and then U.S. authorities separate them from their parents. How can we morally justify that?
Well, what's new is not the policy of separating children. It's doing more prosecutions and doing more criminal prosecutions. Because the policy has always been, if you're prosecuting the adult, you're not going to keep the child with the adult in a criminal facility. So I think the hellish choice here is, do you continue with basically the approach, if you show up with a child at the border, we're going to wave you through, we're going to pay your bus ticket to go find your relatives and give you a summons for a court appearance in a year or two that you probably aren't going to show up for. So if you're a migrant with children, you're just in the country home free or not? If the answer is not, and I think it's no, then I think this approach makes sense, but I'd really prefer to do it when we have more resources, including more family space and detention space, so you wouldn't have to do this sort of separation. But the idea of stopping the flow is the correct one. If we could get Mexico to cooperate even more than they do at the moment and have people apply in Mexico before showing up here, that would be ideal.
This is a really tough issue because I think that for very good reason, the specter of children being separated from their families who are coming to this country with the same set of facts as many contemporary white native-born Americans' ancestors came in. They came through a conveyance. They got here. they applied to want to stay and be a part of the American dream. What's missing here, I think, is a sense of empathy and, most importantly, a sense of leadership in Congress. The reason why we are making all of these enforcement-only decisions is because we have simply not had a Republican Party willing to be responsive to the overwhelming majority of the American people who want immigration reform that includes a path to citizenship, who want dreamers. And the children we're talking about are tomorrow's dreamers, want dreamers, children who are coming here with the same hopes, aspirations, and fears as so many of, I won't say my ancestors because they came here a different way, but so many of the lawmakers' own ancestors came here with. That's the problem. And the problem that particularly the House Republican leadership is unwilling to simply legislate on something that would actually be of benefit to the country, to the economy, and to our values and standing in the world is where I think the blame needs to be, not with children who are going to be put into foster care or whatever.
But if you had such legislation, you wouldn't have fewer migrants showing up the border. You'd have more. And if you talk about polling, if you poll discreetly various enforcement measures, they're overwhelmingly popular as well. So by your logic, we should do those.
The polling I'm talking about is polling that shows that people want comprehensive immigration reform. Yes, if you say, and the fact that even in Trump states, people don't want a deportation-only approach to immigration. I think where we're differing is that you're saying the problem is that people are coming to America. I actually don't think that's a problem.
Are there morally defensible limits on immigration? I mean, if you offered a visa to live in the United States to anyone in the world who wanted it, you would get certainly hundreds of millions of people, maybe a couple of billion people who would accept that offer. It would be a very large number relative to our population. So I guess the question is, where do you, under what circumstances can you say, no, you may not come to the United States, even though you would like to?
But that's not where we are, right?
No, but I mean, we have to be somewhere. I mean, we'd change to a different system where some set of people would be admitted now who currently and other people who would like to be admitted would not be. And so I guess the question is there, under what circumstances is it okay to say to someone, you can't do what my ancestors did and came here? Or is the answer that you can never say that and that we need an open border?
I think that we can certainly have numerical caps that are based on the land that we have, the resources that we have that actually take into consideration the economic benefit that comes from more people being in this country that, frankly, has a lot of resources to spare in terms of both labor and in terms of infrastructure that needs to be built in places where this country doesn't have people populating it. And if you take into consideration what's happening around the world in many cases because of American foreign policy and lack of action on climate change.
But once you say there should be a numerical cap, it does have to be enforced. And that will involve difficult choices, ones you don't want to make based on what you've said previously.
Nick, when we look at the president's complaints about Secretary Nielsen specifically, should we think that he might fire her, that we might see a change of leadership at DHS?
Well, as we've seen before, there can be cabinet officials who have fallen out of favor with the president who stick around for a long time. So it's very hard to make a prediction. One of the difficulties she faces is that she is very much, her fate, I think, is tied to John Kelly's. You know, the president's chief of staff was a more powerful figure last fall when he brought her in. And when he, in many ways, got to make the choice of, you know, who would replace him at DHS. And he is really her only, you know, powerful ally in the White House. His relationship with the president has frayed in recent months. And so, you know, I think if he were to go, she would be on very tenuous footing.
Nick Miroff, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Still with me here are on the left, Heather McGee of Demos, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. Heather, I was hoping to talk with you about Starbucks because you've been closely involved in developing the anti-bias training that the company will be rolling out in a few days. This training was announced as a response to the incident in Philadelphia last month where a manager called police on two black men who were waiting for a colleague to arrive for a meeting before they bought coffee. Initially announced as a one-day training, this is now set to be the first step in a wider anti-bias initiative. Can you talk a little bit about how this came together and how you came to be involved?
Sure, happy to. So just like many other Americans, I watched with outrage as the video circulated online. I have come to know Howard Schultz through a number of different meetings and conferences, the company.
Howard Schultz, the chairman of
Starbucks. The chairman and founder, yes. Yeah. The company's Black employees had invited me 2 years ago to speak at their Black History Month celebration. I'd had some, sort of touch points with the company. And so Howard Schultz called me, also called Sherrilyn Ifill, the head of the NAACP, LDF, and Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, three people very much outside of the corporate world who are nonetheless established leaders on racial and social justice, and asked if we would be willing to advise their efforts to respond. Now, it wasn't an obvious yes for me, I will say. I am not in the business of doing corporate anti-bias training. And frankly, my earliest memory as a child is of actually being chased out of a store by a white store manager with my brother who thought we were going to steal something. So this issue of being Black in spaces of public accommodation is very fraught. And yet, Starbucks's response was not what I expected. They could have simply said, this has nothing to do with race, which is what many companies have said in similar incidences. Walmart had a young man be gunned down in the aisles, John Crawford, and they said this has nothing to do with race. They could have said this is one bad apple, and they didn't. They said this is actually a pervasive problem of racial bias in the country that, of course, affects our 200,000 employees, and we want to take a proactive step. And so what we've done over the past whirlwind, 4 or 5 weeks, has been to help provide an outside set of volunteer pro bono, we're not being paid by the company, eyes and ears on the training that they're putting together and push them to ask broader structural systemic questions. We've connected them with dozens of experts who do this kind of social science work and behavioral change and cultural change in organizations who recognize that bias is pervasive, and yet there are some systems and policies and practices that teams particularly can use to sort of short circuit, which is what is a natural association that the human mind often has that fosters stereotypes. And we've told them that this is not just a Starbucks problem, this is an American problem, that the history of exclusion and discrimination of African Americans and other people of color in public accommodations is something that needs to be a part of the training, that needs to be a part of the context through which this is seen.
My sense, would you agree with this, that the track record of these sorts of trainings is mixed and that some of them seem to work and some don't? What's the how did you guys look at that and sort of trying to figure out, we want to do something, not just something that calls attention and says, hey, we take this seriously as a company, but something that's actually likely to lead to persistent cultural change?
So, yes, like any effort to change the organizational culture of any massive enterprise, there are things that work and then things that don't. So what we did first was that we had interviews with, and the company had interviews with, I think upwards of 40 different experts in this field, and were able to garner some sort of best lessons and practices. And again, I think that what's happening on May 29th is the launch. It's important for the nearly 200,000 frontline employees who are mostly just, you know, working in middle-class Americans who have these part-time jobs, who many of whom did not go to college, even if they're in Starbucks's own sort of free tuition program to Arizona State University, who may not have had some of the basic understanding about American history, and who certainly have often not had the time to sort of sit and reflect about their own personal identities, the power dynamics that attend to different group identities in our society, and to be able to go through role-playing and scenarios about things just like what happened in Philadelphia and how another outcome could be possible.
Rich, we talked about this several weeks ago, sort of right as this had been in the news. And one aspect I find interesting of this is, you know, is corporations, I feel like, take up a larger portion of our emotional space over time. As other institutions recede, people identify more with them emotionally. And sort of like it or not, whether they are well-suited or not, we're going to be relying more on these sorts of entities to engage in social leadership. And it's interesting to see Starbucks, especially because they've basically put themselves out as, you know, we're the third place. We're not just a company. We're part of your community. It's interesting to see them sort of step up here and say, this is our responsibility. And I'm interested to see whether it works or not.
Yeah, Starbucks is more like a public park in effect, because everyone goes there and hangs out. Now, explicitly, you can just go and use the bathroom even if you aren't a customer. I really, I already thought de facto that was the policy of Starbucks.
It is regionally, yeah.
I'm very skeptical of this sort of training, as we talked about previously. I think the main concrete benefit of it will be to signal to its employees and customers that it takes this outrageous incident seriously.
How will we measure after the fact whether the training has worked or not? Is there a rigorous way to look back and figure out whether Starbucks has changed?
I think there isn't a way to show a demonstrable difference from the four-hour training on May 29th, but this overall effort, absolutely. And
but
many
what do
corporations
you measure?
Have done that. You would measure a couple of things. You would take a baseline assessment right now. You know, a company like Starbucks, many retail companies do, you know, spot audits of their stores for lots of different things. You can do a spot audit where you have an African-American and a white person come in and ask for the same kinds of accommodations, find out whether or not how they're treated, basically, in short. And then you can monitor that over time. You can also take consumer sentiment surveys in the communities. I mean, one of the pieces that has become clear through this process is that Starbucks is often, and certainly this was the case in Philadelphia, sort of the leading edge of what on the one hand is good economic development, right? A Starbucks comes to the neighborhood, you know that it's going to have a certain kind of resident following, but that is, you know, for the longtime residents, gentrification. And so what is the sort of relationship and sentiment? Do the longtime residents who may be of color, maybe Asian, African American, Latino, feel welcome in the stores? And I think what they've been surprised by is how that's not always the case.
I've been talking with Heather McGee of Demos and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Stephen Brill, author of the new book, Tailspin. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Heather McGee, president of Demos. And we're joined now by Stephen Brill. He's a journalist, lawyer, and entrepreneur, and he's the author of the new book, Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you.
I want to start by taking issue with your premise. America's 50-year fall. So let's think back to 1968. We had much greater social strife than today, riots, assassinations, domestic terrorism, much of that strife driven by social conditions that were much less open and equal than we see today, with fewer rights for minorities and women. We had a wave of violent crime that had recently begun that would ravage American cities for two decades. Homosexual activity was illegal and policed heavily, even in major cities like New York. And seemingly endless war in Vietnam that imposed greater casualties than the endless wars that we're mired in right now. As for rule of law, you know, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, misusing law enforcement in ways that might even make Donald Trump blush. So when you look at that time compared to today, isn't America drastically better off than we were 50 years ago? I don't know how I can look at that and say tailspin.
A lot of the trends you just mentioned, what I say in the book is they began in the 60s and became exacerbated. And, you know, there isn't any doubt about that. I also take great pains to say in the book that a lot of what ailed America then, in particular racism, has, you know, been alleviated. So I don't think the premise is wrong at all. If you look across sort of the core of what the country's supposed to be, and what the country was always supposed to be, which is a place where the poor and the middle class had the prospect of income mobility. They didn't always get there, but they had a real achievable prospect, and where people were able to participate in the democracy, and where things weren't polarized the way they are. So you actually had, you know, real legislation passed in a bipartisan way, whether it was, Medicare, the civil rights bills, the EPA, the FTC. I mean, you can just go all the way back, but those days are now largely over. So I don't accept your premise.
I mean, just some of those feel like sort of trading one thing for another. I mean, now we have, as you talk about in the book, a politics that's more heavily influenced by money and big spending billionaires. But back then you had
And is ineffective, and nothing happens and nothing gets done across the sphere of everything that even my friend Rich would say we're supposed to look to the government to do in some way or another, repairing roads, have a power grid, have a tax system that's fair, have a democracy where votes actually mean something, be able to have a budget that is balanced. You know, hell, it doesn't even have to be balanced, just has to be passed. We haven't passed a budget since the 90s, so but nothing works.
Heather, what do you make of this critique? Because I know, like, obviously coming from the left, you have a lot of critiques of the way the American, you know, economic and political system works today. Do you think there's a lot of good stuff to look back at in the past and say that we need to reclaim? Or do things work better today than ever and it's a matter of moving forward to even better than that?
Well, I certainly, as a leader of an organization that is focused on the nexus of political and economic inequality, am sympathetic to Steve's point that on those two fronts, whether or not the strength of your voice depends on how much money you have and whether or not you can actually have enough money to feed your family and to get ahead, on those two points, we are doing worse than we were three generations ago. But I think it's not unrelated to the social changes that have happened, but in a different way than the right-wing story would have it. The right-wing story would say the reason why the average American can't get ahead, and that average American in their story is white, is because of all the brown and black and yellow people who are here and taking your jobs and freeloading off the government. It's a very zero-sum story. I would say that what happened in that moment, 50 years ago, was the beginning of a political movement that used nascent backlash from the civil rights movement and to some degree the women's rights movement to create a new political coalition that would be, in the words of a Republican strategist at that convention, the white man's party in all but name. And that coalition, even though so many white Americans have suffered from the economic and political inequality that is wrought, has used racial resentment to create the politics that we have today, where Democrats have not been able to win a majority of white voters since LBJ integrated the country's public accommodations and signed the Voting Rights Act into law. And so I do think it's related. But just not in the way that so many people today want to paint the story.
Again, I don't really agree with the dichotomy of, you know, the purpose of the book isn't to compare, you know, the 50s and 60s and say, you know, those were the good old days compared to what we have today, because there was a lot wrong with the 50s and 60s and the 40s. But what was right was the economic gap between the middle class and the rich was nothing like what it is today. You know, let alone the gap between, you know, the poor and the rich, and equally important, the possibility of moving up today is vastly reduced, and even people's confidence that they can move up is vastly reduced.
Richard, a lot of this is sort of implicit in the Trump critique of the economy, especially this idea that the opening up of the international trade system over the last 50 years has disadvantaged American workers and sort of taken away this deal where you could be a person with a high school education, at the time probably a white male person with a high school education, and get a good job in some industrial concern and support your family in a dignified manner, and that has fallen apart because of economic changes that serve the top rather than the middle.
Yeah, and that the economy is rigged. And this is a critique both the right and the left have their own version of. Steve, I wanted to ask you about something about the elite and its nature. Because
sure.
You know, I wrote a column when Barbara Bush passed away, and there was a lot to be said for the WASP ascendancy in America, but it was exclusive. It wasn't meritocratic. They were blinkered in many ways, but what they were was incredibly public-spirited. We have, you know, a much more open system now, but we somehow seem to have lost that public spiritedness in our elite. How do you recover that?
Well, what the book is about really is, in many ways, you know, too much of a good thing. So, for example, you know, meritocracy. We all love the idea of meritocracy, but meritocracy started to get translated into how much tutoring you could afford to give your kid for the SAT, for example. That's not really meritocracy. That gets to the kind of, you know, lack of equality that we all have to worry about. The public spiritedness that you're talking about, if you look at the world I used to write a lot about, law firms, you know, law firms in the old days did, you know, lots of pro bono work. The partners were all colleagues and friends because they played on, you know, the same lacrosse team at Princeton. But they didn't hire Jews. They certainly didn't hire blacks. And they pretty much, you know, never hired any women. So when meritocracy came to law firms, that was good. On the other hand, when meritocracy began to be translated into how much money the firms can make and whether they make more money than their competitive firms, which is something that I copped to having accelerated with the founding of the American Lawyer, that's not such a good thing. So the key, I think, in all of this stuff is balance. You know, we need to have a balance between the kind of competitive achievement economy that is the core of any kind of a free market economy, and the necessary, you know, spirit of, you know, we all care about the common good. We're all in this together. And I think what is really different today is that the protected, a very small percent of the country, pretty much don't have to worry about the common good or the government providing the common good. Their kids don't go to public schools, or if they do go to public schools, you know, they're in the kind of neighborhoods where the public schools are responsive.
So this is one of your key claims in the book, is basically about errors of investment, both public and private, saying on the public right. side that we're not investing enough in infrastructure, on the private side that businesses face the wrong incentives or, you know, short-sighted.
Yeah, stock buybacks.
Right. Why would the trends that you describe in the book be causing that sort of malinvestment? Don't people at the top of the income spectrum, I mean, if, you know, if we had better investment, presumably we'd have better economic growth. It would make those
better
people even wealthier.
No, because a stock buyback is the single best way for the CEO and the board of any corporation to make more money this quarter, without question, because it raises the stock. And, you know, most compensation for people in the boardroom is based on the increase in value of the stock. So, no, I mean, you know, if they invest in, you know, a new product and a new factory that's going to take, you know, 6 or 8 years to be worth something, they lose. Their workers win, the country wins, but they lose. So what happened was you had all this legal engineering and, you know, finance engineering, all these really smart people, the winners in the meritocracy, they thought up all these things, which no one had ever thought up before, but they were all geared toward the short term.
Heather, do you buy that that was sort of a thing that worked better in the corporate sector back in the 60s, sort of that both when you had higher taxes on corporations and the sort of other incentives facing them, they were less focused on generating profits, and that that somehow led to better long-term investments?
Absolutely. Better long-term investments for the companies and also for the society, which was at the time, particularly when the consumer base was those same middle-class workers, a very virtuous cycle. I completely agree that this has been a dramatic shift. And at Demos, we write a lot about this and the problem with underinvesting in our infrastructure, not just our physical, but our human infrastructure. I would just say, though, this isn't happening in a political vacuum. Mm-hmm. You were saying, Josh, why would investors and people in the elite want to underinvest in the common good? We've got a political philosophy in this country that is ascendant in basically every state house and in on the Supreme Court and in Congress that says that government is the enemy, that wealthy people, because they are made of awesome, and that's how they got wealthy, should be the ones to have the money. That anything that is redistributive at all, whether in the workplace or through the tax and spending system, is immoral. And you can't really have this conversation without talking about how ascendant into the Republican Party that very extreme idea has been. We just had a tax bill that completely gutted our ability to invest in a future that is very uncertain between climate change and our crumbling infrastructure. That's why we're in this place.
Well, Rich, I feel like there's an interesting disconnect here between that tax bill and the policy agenda we've seen under this president and the rhetoric that he's used to talk about the corporate sector that I think does address some of these concerns. I mean, you know, he says, you know, so what if the steel is cheaper from somewhere else? You should buy it here, create jobs in America. Trump does seem to have invigorated this rhetorical idea of corporations having a social responsibility beyond their legal duty to shareholders. But I don't really see where it's shown up in the policy making.
Just like the Trump organization has that sense of responsibility.
Yeah, it hasn't been really realized in the in the policy agenda. The tax bill, I think it had very important corporate reforms that are going to be good for the economy and good ultimately for working people. I think you can criticize that it was too big and unnecessarily big, but what's ultimately going to crowd out investments and things like research and development and infrastructure isn't the tax system, it's the entitlement system. And the fact that that will take on, especially as the population ages, more and more, greater and greater proportion of the budget, and there's not going to be much money for anything else. So we have to ultimately choose whether we want to stick with just an ever bigger entitlement state or intelligently reform the system over time. Democrats are opposed to that root and branch, and Republicans don't have much appetite for it, especially when their president is also opposed to it at the moment.
Well, there's a reason for that, though, Rich, because corporations have walked away from providing any kind of retirement security. I mean, it would be very interesting to say, sure, let's cut retirement benefits if, in fact, the third leg of the stool beyond personal savings and Social Security and Medicare, private pensions, was not basically disappearing overnight in the course of one generation.
You could make changes that would be focused on more affluent people and scaling back their benefits. You can't even do that.
The way to deal with the two ticking time bombs of entitlements is not to cut the entitlements. It's, A, if you're talking about Medicare, is actually do something about healthcare prices. Now, the president, you know, he has talked about, you know, drug prices. He submitted a plan that's a joke. Everybody knows it's a joke. The stocks of the drug companies went up immediately after he submitted the plan. But you have to do something about hospital costs and hospital profits and, you know, medical device profits. But to come back to your point, if you want to do something about, you know, Social Security, you don't cut Social Security. You tax people, you know, way beyond the ceiling that you have now. You tax people all the way up for Social Security benefits, and that would solve that. That would solve that problem immediately.
Can I zoom out a little bit? So, like, I mean, we can do math on how to allocate the federal budget. But what do you see as the solution to the tailspin? If you see that there have been, you know, various incentives that have been misaligned that cause policymakers to make systematically bad decisions.
Well, here's what I think is going to happen, and this is, it's either way too pessimistic or way too optimistic or both. But I think that things are going to get so bad that they're going to get good. And what I mean by that is that, you know, just take the coal miners, okay? At some point, the coal miners, you know, in the deepest recesses of Kentucky and West Virginia are going to realize, guess what? You know, President Trump actually didn't get me my job back. He scammed me. I don't have my job. I mean, that's an easily knowable fact if you're an unemployed, you know, coal miner. Are you working? Did you get your job back? Did your company get revived or not? At some point, as the galloping costs of healthcare keeps raising the copays and the deductibles, even for people who have, you know, really good insurance on their jobs, I think people are going to snap. And the challenge is you have to have the kind of political leaders not who try to separate and divide the poor from the middle class, but who know how to unite them. Because the truth is, the middle class is becoming much more like the poor than ever.
Unfortunately, I have to leave it there. Steve Brill is the author of the new book, Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. Thank you so much, Stephen, for
joining
us.
Thanks, Josh. It was fun.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
The federal judiciary has issued forth with any number of bizarre and indefensible decisions in the Trump era, but one this week is unsurpassed in its stupidity. A judge ruled that President Trump cannot permissibly block people on Twitter because it violates the First Amendment, demonstrating that this judge in question doesn't understand Twitter, the First Amendment, or common sense.
Heather McGee, what's on your mind?
My rant is about something that actually I think has not gotten enough attention, which is the gag rule that the Trump administration put through this week that would make it illegal for healthcare providers, hospitals, and community health centers across the country that participate in the Title X funding program to refer their patients for safe, legal abortion. The fact is that the majority of women who choose to terminate a pregnancy are already mothers. This is an issue that has become so politicized and so taken out of the way that women and their families experience trying to plan their pregnancies and their parenthoods. And the idea that we would say that healthcare should not include even a referral to abortion services is just outside of the mainstream. It's dangerous. And I think it's part of the Trump agenda that people should be paying more attention to.
For my rant, President Trump spoke Tuesday at a dinner for the Susan B. Anthony List, an anti-abortion political group. And he said this.
So your vote in 2018 is every bit as important as your vote in 2016. Although I'm not sure I really believe that, but, you know. I don't know who the hell wrote that line. I'm not sure.
That's the big question for Republicans. Will Trump supporters think it's as important to turn out in 2018 as they did in 2016? Over the last few weeks, the Democratic advantage in national polling about the congressional vote has been narrowing. But Democrats have taken solace in despite of that because of their enthusiasm advantage. That is that Democrats are more likely to think that voting really is very important this year. But Harry Enthin from CNN notes a data point that should make Democrats nervous. Their overperformance in special elections, one of the main indicators of that superior enthusiasm, has waned since April 1st. Democratic candidates are still running ahead of Hillary Clinton on average, but not by as much as they were a few months prior. It's a reason to think the national polls might be right, and the stronger economy and quieter Congress are improving Republican chances in November. I have a correction about Stefan Halper, who's been identified by the Washington Post as the FBI's confidential informant about the Trump campaign and Russia. On our special extra episode with Ken White this Wednesday, I described Halper as a professor at Oxford. He's actually an emeritus professor at Cambridge. I regret the error. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Heather McGee, Evelyn Farkas, Nick Miroff, and Stephen Brill. Sarah Fay produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.